ExxonMobil's return on capital employed, the metric Raymond had long promoted as the best indicator of an oil company's performance, came in at 31% during his last year, a jaw-dropping number, and the best in the corporation's peer group that year. The gap between ExxonMobil and its competitors in this self-assigned category reflected in part the superior performance of its chemical business and its downstream refinery division, where Raymond and his colleagues had driven annual profits to $8 billion, a fourfold rise in 4 years. Raymond had risen within Exxon mainly as a downstream performer, and he left behind the oil industry's strongest refining and petrochemical businesses, bar none, as the Wall Street analyst Mark Gilman put it. For all of these stellar financial accomplishments, yellow warning lights were blinking about ExxonMobil's future. Annual oil and gas production remained flat, no higher than it was at the time of the Mobil merger, despite repeated promises from Raymond and other executives that production would rise. Upstream oil and gas production generated industry-leading profits because of ExxonMobil's discipline in project investment and operations. But strategically, in Gilman's view, Raymond did not position the company properly in the upstream business, where most of the industry's profits and potential lay. The Mobil acquisition was a triumph, Gilman believed, but afterward, they milked the developed inventory that had been previously established. There was little left for his successor to draw on. Global interdependency and the rise of state-owned oil companies meant that, in the long run, access to new oil and gas properties would require cooperative partnerships with myriad governments and foreign rival companies. But Raymond had exacerbated Exxon's historical organizational arrogance, and so they were, not in my view, the favored partners. Gilman was something of a contrarian about ExxonMobil's performance. Many other Wall Street analysts praised the corporation, offering few caveats. But in Gilman's analysis, the failure to find new oil was also inextricably tied to ExxonMobil's relentless drive for superior profits. The very discipline that ExxonMobil bragged about to Wall Street analysts at the annual presentation, its insistence that it would release cash to invest in new oil projects only if the returns would be 15% or more annually, had imprisoned the company in a cycle of flat or declining production and reserve replacement struggles. The basic problem is that their threshold returns are too high, way too high, so they end up with gobs of excess cash without a sound strategy for long-term production growth. This was not necessarily a problem limited to ExxonMobil. As Big Oil announces record profits, wrote the analyst Amy Myers Jaffe, you have to ask yourself, can anyone out there find oil anymore? What happened to those wildcatters of yesteryear? Do they only search for stock dividend plays now, not promising extensions to geologic structures? The corporation claimed that 2005 was the 12th consecutive year in which it had found enough proved reserves of oil and gas to replace the amount pumped and sold. But this was true only if an investor accepted ExxonMobil's self-generated rules for reserve counting and ignored the rules issued by the SEC. Doubters like Gilman and Jaffe might question long-term strategy, but ExxonMobil's reputation as the best steward of shareholder capital delivered a premium share price in comparison with its oil industry peers. UBS Warburg estimated toward the end of Raymond's run that ExxonMobil's stock, because of market expectations about its superior future performance, enjoyed a 7.3% price premium in comparison to BP's and even more in comparison to Royal Dutch Shell's. The corporation's net income in 2005 was greater than the combined profits of the next 5 largest publicly traded American corporations, as ranked by revenue. To be sure, sheer size and rising oil prices caused by factors outside of ExxonMobil's control were largely responsible, but Raymond had forged the management systems that put the corporation into position to reap the rewards. After the 1999 merger, ExxonMobil had jockeyed with Microsoft and General Electric for the status of largest American company by total stock market value. But as Raymond retired, ExxonMobil moved into the top spot. Walmart earned more revenue in some years, but as a retailer, its profit margins were relatively thin. ExxonMobil generated more profit than any other company in the world. The corporation had 83,700 employees and 2.5 million individual shareholders. If that community of interest was defined as ExxonMobil's population, it was about the same size as tiny oil-rich Kuwait's, yet the latter's national income in 2005 was only about $100 billion, or less than a third of ExxonMobil's revenue. ExxonMobil citizenship, then, particularly for senior managers and executives with lucrative restricted stock packages, had become highly rewarding, even if it involved constraints on personal freedom that a Kuwaiti subject might also recognize. Even the corporation's lower-paid employees enjoyed wages, retirement security, and income growth unavailable to the vast majority of comparable American workers. After he formally retired, as part of a $1 million per year transition consultancy, Raymond embarked with his wife Charlene on an ExxonMobil Challenger jet from Dallas Love Field to Paris. For almost a month, the Raymonds circled the world on a farewell tour, touching down in Norway, London, and Singapore, before they cleared customs and re-entered the United States and Hawaii. They stayed a few days on the Big Island. Raymond's journey from Watertown, South Dakota, was over, and his family was now wealthy beyond imagination. Following formulas for executive retirements the corporation had previously established, and taking into account the compensation he had deferred over the course of his 40-year career, ExxonMobil's board of directors awarded Lee Raymond pension benefits as a lump sum of $98 million, restricted shares worth $183 million, stock options with a potential value of $70 million, the $1 million consultancy, and reimbursement of his country club fees. Altogether, his retirement package was worth just under $400 million.